from the University of Washington in Seattle, a warm welcome to Dr. Peter Ward, author of Under a Green Sky. Hello, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
Well, of course, you know, we all want to know how the sky could be green, but that story does take a little bit of introduction. Could we start with your summer field trip? Can you tell us what that was about?
Well, I was lucky enough to get to go to Australia, down under, way up north and down under, so one of the hottest parts. We're looking at very ancient rocks, Devonian-aged rocks, and interestingly enough, the same aged rocks that makes up much of the front ranges in Alberta, where we Americans get a lot of natural gas, and you Canadians too, is from the Alberta province and ancient coral reefs. So we're looking at similarly aged coral reefs of Devonian age. There was a big mass extinction among them, and we're trying to figure out why is it that about 360 million years ago, over half the species on Earth rather suddenly died out. Both Canada, Australia, every place in the globe experienced this big biotic crisis. So that was really the impetus to send us down under.
Well, that's something we certainly need to know about. I mean, is it even conceivably possible that we could have another mass extinction like that?
Yeah, that's the interesting question, all right. And certainly in America right now, we're having the political season, and there's charges back and forth and forth and back, and it's very hard to get a rational point of view. But it looks like there's a really strong chance, possibility at least, that we may elect someone who has a vice president who neither believes in global warming nor in evolution. So here we have it, someone, a heartbeat for the presidency or could be president, who believes that there is no such thing as global warming in any way, shape, or form, and secondly, that evolution doesn't work. So some big designer in the sky did everything. What a combination, huh?
Yeah, that's politics, but underlying politics, too, we also have the public knowledge, and I think that the public needs to hear the kind of work that you're doing, and I wanted to give you this chance, if you would, to outline some of the process of these past extinctions and how we can study them at all.
Well, interestingly, we're really in a brand new era. It's very exciting. We have developed, not we, I wish I could say I was part of it, but my colleagues around the world in many disciplines have developed powerful new methods of understanding past biology. The way we paleontologists, and I'm a old-style paleontologist, I'm proud to say, trained in Canada, got my PhD in McMaster by Toronto and Hamilton. The way I learned it is that we went out, found a fossil, and made our interpretations. But now there's a whole new generation that goes out and takes the rock that my fossil may have come from, extracts the organic oils that are present in so many of these rocks, and then analyzes the compounds within these beautiful golden little droplets of oil that you can squeeze out of these rocks. And within these, there can be interior pieces still preserved of ancient microbes. This generally cell walls are so tough, microbial cell walls are so tough, that we can really glean important information on who are the dominant microbes at any given past. That has led to a great revolution. And one of the things we were doing in Australia and then later in Nevada, and soon as soon as it gets to be summer ending here, I'm going to head to Antarctica and do the same. We're going to try to understand if we had microbes at the major mass extinctions, which seem to correlate to times of very high heat and low oxygen in the oceans. The oceans themselves can lose their oxygen if we have a globally warmed world. If you think about it, what makes wind? Well, wind is simply air masses that are going from warm places to cold places or cold to warm. Let's say we take a globe that has a nice cold pole, as we do now at both ends, and warm in the middle. Well, the warm wants to go to the cold and the cold to the warm, and hence we have beautiful winds and currents and ocean currents. And the whole circulation system is based on this world that is warm at one point and cool somewhere else. If we warm the whole thing relatively, there's no more driving force for currents and no more driving force for big air currents or ocean currents. Things stagnate, and when they stagnate, oxygen goes away. When oxygen disappears, whole different regimes of microbes can take over the oceans, and they seem to have done this in the past. Well, in the past, it wasn't we humans, of course, that were globing the world, warming the world. It was volcanoes and monstrous volcanic outpourings of a type that haven't happened in actually tens of millions of years. But back then, they did. And very quickly, the world warmed to the point with greenhouse gases that the poles warmed drastically, It turns out through the physics of warming, which I don't understand but I'm told works, is that the tropics can't get much warmer than they are. They're already heated to about the point they can, but the poles obviously can. And I saw the news report this morning of gigantic bits of polar ice breaking loose and cutting loose into Canadian seas up there. So we're really seeing unprecedented change in the ice caps, and it's through global warming.
And then it seems that the ocean somehow could become poisonous, if I understand the theory in your book right. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. One of the microbial groups that does best when there's no oxygen is a form that produces hydrogen sulfide. And hydrogen sulfide is a great poison. It's that rotten egg smell. And the reason that we react so strongly to it and hate it so much is that it is at very small concentrations, parts per million, can kill we humans. I mean, just the tiniest whiff of this stuff, we're so sensitive to it because we know intuitively or deep in our cells that this is poison. We cannot deal with this stuff. Stay away, stay away. And yet when we have an ocean with no oxygen at its bottom, and worse, there's no oxygen at its top, these microbes take over, and they can start producing, if they get enough nutrients, they can start producing enormous amounts of hydrogen sulfide. The hydrogen sulfide is a poison to all animals and plants. So it's not a good thing, and the microbes have produced this hydrogen sulfide have left behind little biomarkers, little bits and pieces of their cell walls in these Australian rocks we looked at. We've gotten the same stuff coming from your nice Canadian rocks of the same age. And in fact, we've now found these about 10 or 13 time intervals in the past, all coinciding with rapid global warming through volcanic events.
Yeah, you know, it's so surprising to me because before I read your book, I think like most people, I thought that the past extinctions, what little I knew of them, were caused by asteroid or comet hits. But now we're finding out just since the year 2000 that it's climate change.
Well, there's still the death of the dinosaurs is still very reliably pinned on a bad asteroid. But so well did the Alvarez group of Berkeley convince the world that this was the method that everybody said, well, gee, if it happened back in the Cretaceous 65 million years ago, well, surely all the other mass extinctions could have plausibly been caused by this. And in spite of very little of evidence that any of the other mass extinctions about impact, because there is reliable evidence of impact, there's bits and pieces of the asteroid, for instance, and country rock that can be thrown up into the space and come back down, bits of the crater and a crater itself. In spite of the absence of really good evidence of this in any of the other mass extinctions, somehow this since about 1990, this creeping sense that they were all caused by asteroids has taken over science. And it's just now that we're starting to say, well, wait a minute. How about this? How do you correspond these microbial bits and pieces we're finding from these aged rocks with the possibility that we had an asteroid? There's no way an asteroid could stop the oceans from having oxygen. Global warming can. And so this is where we're starting to see one of these scientific revolutions and change as people start realizing, oh my gosh, you know, if it happened in the past, could it happen again? Is CO2? That's the problem. You know, we just because we have it being made by humans, it's still the same molecule. It still has the same physics. It still causes our atmosphere to warm, and it still causes our Arctic to be radically warmed as we are seeing right now.
Yes, we just lost one of our five ice shelves, I believe, in northern Canada. You know, I was wondering, too, in your book, you credit another scientist, Andrew Knoll, for publishing a vision of how climate might have killed off the species. That was in the late 90s. How does your work build on or differ from his?
Well, Andy and I are long-term, old-time colleagues, and I'm just a huge fan of his work and proponent of what he's done. I don't know a single case where he's ever been wrong about anything. I'm sure his wife would tell me the opposite. But scientifically, you know, he's been gold standard. And what I've tried to do, Andy, in terms of past mass extinctions, concentrated mainly on the Permian. And we've tried to branch out with colleagues, including Canadian colleagues, to look at others of the so-called Big Five. You know, there were five major events during the age of animals, which is the last 500 million years. And one of these was the dinosaur killer. One was the Permian extinction of 250 million years ago, where we are now again finding the presence of these hydrogen sulfide bacteria, one in the Devonian. This is the one we're studying in Western Canada and Australia. One at the end of the Triassic 200 million years ago. where the best site to study it is in British Columbia at Kennecott Point in the Queen Charlotte Islands, and one in the Ordovician, where I just came from, and this is studies we're doing in Nevada, but there are wonderful rocks of this particular age in the Rockies as well. So, yes, it's been an interesting adventure.
Well, one of the problems that I have, and I think my listeners probably have, is how to integrate this shocking, I would say, science into our mental consciousness. I mean, we go out, the streets look the same, the houses look the same, but we know that, well, you could say we're the new volcanoes. We're creating conditions that that could drive a climate change that moves faster than we think. How do you deal with it personally? You've got kids, you've got a future invested, so do I. You've got students. How are they dealing with it? How do you integrate this knowledge?
Well, part of it is I try not to get too depressed when it just is clear that if you yell and scream and have the best arguments in the world, there will only ever be limited acceptance when the world has become so politicized. The thing I love about Canada and always have is that the discourse there always seems more reasonable. And we are so separated in this red-blue nonsense down here, and it's not just political. It becomes what scientific point of view am I going to accept or not? And there's this still nonsensical debate going on here on whether or not global warming exists, and if it does, could humans have done anything about it when the sources are... Al Gore is correct. I mean, we've moved on. The scientists, at least, have moved on beyond that, that we must take into account from a societal point of view that this is a very grave danger. And the way I try to express it, at least to our politicians on the rare chances I get to talk to them, is that, well, look, you know, what if we global warming chicken littles are incorrect and it turns out that we are wrong? There's no way that humans are doing anything. Well, the stuff that we're advocating, moving away from carbon economy, moving away from cars which use too much oil, moving away from very wasteful technology that we throw away in the dumps, moving away from that stuff, even if we're wrong, it's still going to help society. We still need to do that, global warming or no global warming. If we're right and we don't do anything, well, there goes civilization as we know it. Perhaps not in our time, but our children's children will certainly be suffering the onslaught. And the most dangerous onslaught that will soon be occurring, I believe, is sea level rise. I mean, melting all the ice sheets, which is happening now, has a dire effect on the coastlines, a city like Vancouver. What's going to happen to Vancouver if we have a 20-foot rise in sea level, or my own Seattle where I live? I mean, this is quite an amazing thing, that if you take a city, which I've done, of the city of Seattle, and just take a map and take the 20-foot contour, and then say everything below that 20-foot contour is now underwater, well, you've got a very different city. It's a disaster.
Yeah, and it may weaken us to the point where we don't really have the resources to respond then, whereas now we still have all the machinery and the cement or whatever we need to, I guess we might need to move our cities unless we change our society, as you suggest, and reduce our fossil fuel emissions. Well, this is Radio EcoShock with scientist Peter Ward. His whole field of paleontology has been swept from the back rooms of collecting right into the front pages of the newspapers. Dr. Ward, your book, Under a Green Sky, came out in late 2007, but even though I follow climate affairs, it took me almost 8 months to get the book and get your message. I worry that the slow pace of communicating new science all the way out to the busy public and the politicians, it might be too slow to save us. So what can we do?
Well, my biggest fear, of course, is that we are the converted are speaking to the converted. The book that I wrote, Under Green Sky, sold so horribly that the book company just dropped me. They don't want to deal with this. They said, no, there's no sales here. This is science, and it's just too scary. And the people who do read it are people who are already convinced that, gee, something's got to be done. So the big question is, how do you get to the people who don't read? And in America, I think the figures are so astonishing. I think we have 30 million people out of 300 million who regularly read, what you could call readers, who go out and actively buy books and go to the libraries and keep track of stuff. And so that's a very small percentage, obviously. How do you go to the rest? And the rest is through television. And so what I've been doing, and this may sound awful, but I think it's sort of, maybe it's my last gasp and last hope. I'm the scientific coordinator of a large new series for Animal Planet, which is one of the networks. And we're doing a 8-hour series called Animal Armageddon, not my title. We're going to take these mass extinctions and we're going to populate them with CG, beautiful dinosaurs and all the creatures. And mass extinction by mass extinction, I intend to show that it's not just asteroids, but it is global warming, and that global warming can be produced, as we'll see, by these volcanoes in many ways. And I hope that people who watch television, a light bulb will go on, and they'll say, aha, well, wait a minute, if carbon dioxide can do that, and cars make carbon dioxide, wait, do you mean? And so I'm just hoping. Now, if we get conversion of one person who doesn't read, who does watch TV, I mean, there's one extra person, right? So what else can you do?
I agree, and, well, this actually sounds pretty exciting to me, so that would be Animal Planet. Do you have any idea when it might come out?
I do. It's going to be out early 2009, so January or February, Animal Armageddon. We've populated it with some of my favorite creatures, not just dinosaurs, but Permian mammal-like reptiles. We're going to have Ordovician early fish and nautilite cephalopods. We're going to have Devonian early amphibians. We're going to have Triassic early archosaurs. We're going to have mammals. We're going to have a lot of really interesting animals going through, event by event, these various what I call greenhouse extinctions, getting the point across. It's kind of like, I don't care who you are animal-wise, when it gets too warm, the world goes sideways and bad things happen.
Well, I could sort of see a two-level approach to this. You know, one definitely is public education, which I see you working on, and I'm happy to hear that. And the other is to somehow get to our leadership, and hopefully we get better leadership, and get something going. Because, like, the Brookings Institute, for example, just came out with an editorial, an op-ed in the Washington Post, and they said, 7 years to climate midnight. So whoever takes over in 2009, they've got to about 2015 to make real action to stop this flow of carbon and to help the rest of the world do it. Or we may run into irreversible climate change, and who knows what could happen then.
Well, we certainly have a clock that's ticking. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The rate at which carbon dioxide is going up now is very regular. Up it goes. We're at 380 and something, and it's going up about 2 parts per million per year. Everybody that I know of in the climate change industry thinks that 500 is definitely tipping point dangerous, that we really should cap it in the mid-400s if we can, bring it back down if we can. Perhaps we maybe brush 500, but bring it down. But we cannot sustain a world at 500 parts per million. I mean, that already puts us at CO2 levels that are higher than anything in the last 20 million years and maybe way longer. We are going to geologically historic levels. I mean, we're higher than any time in the ice ages. We are really, really going back in time. And back in time means no ice caps. No ice caps, no ice caps or ice sheets means not just a 20-foot sea level rise, but a 240-foot sea level rise, 80 meters. I think that's catastrophe in anybody's point of view. Now, let's say we coordinate that in the next 150, 200 years, and it correlates well with the rise in human population to 8 to 9 to 10, maybe 11 billion people. When sea level rise hits maximum human population, there's nothing but disaster in that recipe. There's not enough food already. Let's say we remove a great proportion of the arable food, and much of the food of the Earth comes from deltas now, and every delta on the planet is going to be gone, not with a 240-foot sea level rise, but a 10-foot sea level rise or less removes every delta. And that's probably about 25% of crops being produced right now. So there's urgency here. There's urgency here.
You've also described in your book Life Under the Sea from your explorations as a professional-grade diver, I guess I would say. And you've expressed a real worry about the sea and its future, and it seems like that's sort of the mother of life, if you want to say. I can't picture it being all fished out and then losing oxygen. We've got the dead zones going. What can we do to help the sea, in your opinion, as far as this climate shift is going?
Well, certainly we need to really think hard about our the way we eat fish and what fish we do eat. The big debate in my state and probably in your maritime provinces is fish farming versus non-fish farming, because clearly I mean, there's sins to both sides. If you overfish, I mean, that there's a stock that's gone, and that affects everything. On the other hand, some of the fish farming that takes place, salmon farming in Washington State, for instance, by necessity, so much of the food escapes that it produces great balloons of algae on the bottom that then produces these oxygen-free zones. And we've, you know, it's kind of darned if you do and darned if you don't. But what we really need to stop doing is over-harvesting. And that's quite clear that so many of the great stocks, I mean, look at the cod stocks off eastern Canada. My gosh, no one ever thought there could ever be a dent in that resource. And we now know that more and more fishermen fight over a very dwindling and crashing resource. You see fights almost between the Spanish who come out and the Canadians who are there and the Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, this is right in the center of the media center of Canada. It's right in your front doorstep. This is a crash that should be telling us something about not just Canada, but the whole world.
I think a lot of Canadians have taken that one to heart, but I'm thinking, too, about the acidification of the ocean and what's happening with the reefs, that the coral reefs. That seems to be climate-related, would you say?
It absolutely is, and it's not just the coral reefs. Well, the coral reefs themselves are under great stress, as we know, and what you're saying is correct. The ocean has been one of our greatest allies in dealing with carbon dioxide. So much CO2 from the atmosphere in excess quantity is absorbed, dissolved into seawater. I mean, the oceans have been this great buffering system that have allowed us to really get away with far more CO2 than should be up there. But nevertheless, we've gotten away with it because the oceans are saying, okay, I'll take some more of that. But there are limits, and the limits have been certainly reached in the Arctic oceans, where we now know that certain of the very low in the food chain mollusks called pteropods are now living in oceans just slightly acid enough that they are having a great trouble producing their calcium carbonate shell. It is, in fact, dissolving off their backs, killing them. The coral reefs are under the same sort of stress. They are calcifying organisms, and the increased acidity from more CO2 has led them, but also the great heat we find in the coral reefs. I have a project now, the Great Barrier Reef, that I've been going to for 3 years, tracking the chambered nautilus, an animal I began studying early in my career, and I'm back to it late in my career. But the Great Barrier Reef and many of the reefs are undergoing what we call bleaching. This is a loss of the symbiotic small algae that corals have within their flesh. If it gets too warm, these jump out. When that happens, the coral can no longer calcify as reliably as it did. And corals are always have been on a balance between growth and the destruction around them of bio-eroding creatures, of waves, of hurricanes, of storms. It's been just a nice balance. Well, that balance is disrupted. So in the Arctic and in the tropics both, excess CO2 has had a very, very dangerous effect on the ecosystems.
Now, in your field of paleontology, and as we relate it to extreme climate change, can you tell me what are some of the things that we really don't know that we need to know? What do we have to find out here?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one that I've just been banging my head even the last couple of nights. The best climate source on the web by far is called realclimate.org. I'm not associated with it. I wish I were. This is done by 5 or 6 really good independent climate people. It was named, I think, one of the 50 best websites of any website in the world. Realclimate.org looks daily at the climate challenges, and these guys have brought to my attention something that's really scared me from paleontology. Can you have ice sheets, ice caps in a high CO2 world? You know, maybe we can get away with it in the sense that maybe we can get up to higher carbon dioxide. We need to know from the geological past, was there any time in the past when carbon dioxide was 500 parts per million or higher when we still had ice? Is there any way, perhaps, can we learn a trick that tells us, well, we just can't bring CO2 quite down enough, but look, there's still some ice sheets here. Maybe we have a little more time than we thought. And so these sorts of really interesting deep time examples and lessons are showing us a great deal about climate, things that we didn't know that I think are very germane to the argument today.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you'd really like to tell our listeners, a sort of take-home message, if you will?
Well, I just think that what we need to do is talk to our kids and read to them. Turn them into readers. I mean, that's the simplest way, I think, to save the world is produce more readers, because it's going to be the readers that save it or not.
This is Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington in Seattle. He's the author of a revolutionary new book, I think. Well, it's not a new book, but I really like it. I think it's well written, it's science well told, and it's necessary information. I'm going to tell my listeners, if you read only one book this fall, this would be it. So maybe the sales haven't been great so far, but they should be. This is a book people need to read. Peter, thanks so much. We really appreciate your time with us today.
And anytime you want me back or anything I can do to help, just call.
That is a very kind offer, and I'll take you up on it. Bye-bye for now.